Welcome to GI Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Len Saltz to get his take on recent clinical research developments in colorectal cancer and beyond, and he began by commenting on regorafenib, the first tyrosine kinase inhibitor to demonstrate efficacy in a phase 3 trial in metastatic colorectal cancer, an agent that has subsequently been approved for use.
Regorafenib is a molecule extremely similar to sorafenib. It's basically sorafenib with a fluorine atom added to it. And the correct trial was a large-scale randomized phase 3 study in which patients were selected on the basis of having progressed through all reasonable standard therapy options. So these are, unfortunately, a type of patient that we see not infrequently in our practice, somebody who is still functioning at a high level, still has a reasonably good performance status and good end organ function, but has run out of ideas. So these were people that had exhausted a oxaliplatin and irinotecan and fluoropyrimidine option, and for those that were KRAS wild type had exhausted an anti-EGFR option as well. And when they looked at the population that received regorafenib as opposed to the placebo control, there was a median 1.4-month survival benefit. Now, this is a recurrent number that we'll talk about a few times today, 1.4. It seems to be kind of jumping out at us, so we're getting a little bit of Kabbalah-like numerology here. Of course, everybody would hope for better. It's not a huge difference. It invites discussion of what is a clinically meaningful benefit, and I think if we started out by saying we're going to design a clinical trial with the expressed target endpoint of coming up with less than a 2-month benefit in survival, I think that would be a difficult sell. But the reality is that is what happened, and it is a statistically significant difference.
Can I just ask, in terms of this point, when you see these absolute numbers, and for example, the 1.4 in survival that you mentioned, another number that also is out there is the relative risk reduction. And is it possible that it maybe not as late line patient, for example, that you would actually see a greater absolute benefit?
Well, we are hoping to learn that in clinical investigations. But of course, the way that the drug is going to be approved is going to be in the indication under which it was studied. What its utility is going to be in earlier phase treatment, either by itself or in combination, is going to be the study of investigation for some time, and we're not going to know that. I would hope that using it in an earlier phase would provide a greater degree of benefit. But remember, we didn't necessarily see that with the anti-EGFR agents. If you go back to the initial data for cetuximab, we see in the NCIC CO17 trial, which was a similar population, you know, end-stage patients who have exhausted standard therapy but still have a good performance status, the survival benefit there is certainly in the same ballpark, and if you want to nitpick, is a little bit better numerically than the survival benefit we see for the KRAS-selected patients in the frontline studies. So the hope that the activity seen in refractory disease would translate into a bigger degree of activity in frontline has not been realized in the EGFR agents, and I think we have to be careful about whether that will happen with regorafenib or not.
I guess one of the issues here is it is an oral agent. I'm not sure clinically exactly what the toxicity is, whether it's similar to sorafenib or better or worse. Do you have any sense for that?
So I don't have any indication that it's better than sorafenib, and there are some concerns in non-randomized comparisons that it might be a little more difficult on patients than sorafenib. The correct trial was done in patients that have had a fair amount of therapy, whereas most of the sorafenib studies have been in upfront. And, you know, when we look at the data from, say, the hepatocellular frontline SHARP trial, that was a pretty good group of patients. And it may just be that as patients get a little sicker, the toxicity looks a little more worrisome.
I was trying to remember, has sorafenib been studied in colon cancer?
As a single agent in this setting, I'm not aware of such a study. There were trials where it was the variable in combination with FOLFIRI regimen, and that was stopped early for futility. So it didn't show, we don't have evidence that sorafenib is an active agent. And I think it would be a big misunderstanding for people to interpret the regorafenib data as a reason to try sorafenib in a colon cancer patient. I don't think we should do that.
I was trying to think about what we know about TKIs in colon cancer. I know there was that big study Randy Heck presented a few years ago, the PTK was a negative study.
That's correct. So this is the first TKI that I'm aware of where we have data that this is a useful agent. And I don't think we really have another TKI that we can bring to bear right now. From a mechanistic point of view, of course, that's interesting. The patients are less concerned with, you know, whether it's a TKI or an antibody or what the mechanism of action is. They want to know, how can it help them? What's the upside? What's the downside? And I think that we have to recognize this is an agent with some activity. Now, that's exciting because that's new for us. We've been in the doldrums in colorectal cancer for a decade or so. We brought the EGFR antibodies on board. We brought the anti-VEGF antibodies on board. And then we've had a series of negative studies. So it's at least a refreshing relief for all of us to have a positive trial to talk about. And what I think is really important is when you look at the curves for the regorafenib study, you see a very, very interesting pattern. You see that the curves don't separate for the first couple of months, and then they separate dramatically. And what the curves scream out for is a biomarker, which may be elusive, but one day we're going to find it and we're going to figure out who are the people that are benefiting. Because clearly a substantial population, slightly more than half, are getting nothing out of this drug. But then the other half are getting unequivocal benefit compared to the placebo. And of course, when we don't know who is in which camp, there's going to be, I think, an appropriate desire to give the patient the opportunity to benefit from the drug. I do think it's important to bear in mind the study was done in people with really good performance status. These were ECOG 0 and 1 patients that met the eligibility criteria for a randomized phase 3 study. We always have to be very careful about extrapolating that information to a very infirmed patient. So a patient with a very poor performance status with multiple medical comorbidities, a patient who's jaundiced, a patient with renal insufficiency, a patient whose bone marrow is shot, we don't know yet what the risk-benefit ratio for regorafenib is in such a patient, and we have to be very careful to recognize that when we make our decisions.
So can you envision situations where, for example, you might want to use it before an EGFR antibody?
I think you certainly could envision such a scenario. Whether there will be reimbursement issues with that or not, I don't know. We'll have to be aware of that because we can anticipate that this drug will be priced in the range of other new and expensive TKIs and other diseases. And we're going to have to be careful, you know, to protect our patients and ourselves from situations where the drug is not reimbursed and the bill is going to be substantial. However, I think that different side effects are more or less important to different patients. And when we talk about personalized medicine, we talk about individualization of care, while of course what we ultimately want is intelligent molecular selection of patients so that they can benefit the most and have toxicity the least. But in the short run, we have the ability to discuss openly and frankly with patients, what are the known risks of each of the agents, and some will be more acceptable than others. So just as for some patients, the neurotoxicity of oxaliplatin is more or less of a problem, the alopecia issues of irinotecan more or less of a problem, regorafenib looks like fatigue may be an issue that we have to deal with in a non-trivial number of patients. The rash of cetuximab and panitumumab is a very substantial side effect that is very problematic for a lot of people. And it's one of the reasons that I have been reluctant to embrace those agents routinely in frontline settings. I use them more in a third line setting in my practice primarily. So I could easily envision a patient who said, I'd really rather hold off exposure to the skin toxicity and give regorafenib a trial first. I hope that opportunity will be available to us.
So as long as we're on that topic, I'm just kind of curious, because I know you talked to me before about this issue of the dermatologic toxicity of EGFR antibodies. Do you have any perspective on say, your typical use of these agents compared to the average oncologist in practice?
I think patients who have a KRAS wild-type tumor need to have EGFR agents considered as part of their continuum of care. I don't think in this country they've been widely embraced in the frontline setting, and I don't use them in the frontline setting for the most part. The important difference is in patients where I have a realistic chance at converting an unresectable patient to resectable, and I want to emphasize that that is unfortunately a relatively small number of patients. I think that that concept of conversion to resectability is misunderstood and is a little bit overblown. But when I really believe that's the case, if I have a KRAS wild-type tumor, then I'm impressed with the response benefit from anti-EGFR agents, and I do use those in that frontline setting.
So perhaps you can comment on the second really major colorectal cancer paper presented at ASCO, the much-anticipated study of continuation of bevacizumab when metastatic disease progression.
Sure. The so-called TML study, I think, is an important study that also should influence the way that we think about approaching the continuum of care for our patients. As I think most people are aware, bevacizumab was first validated as a useful agent in colorectal cancer in the first-line metastatic setting, and that was the study done by Dr. Hurwitz. There was a subsequent trial published by Bruce Giantonio, the ECOG 3200 study, that demonstrated that adding of bevacizumab to second-line FOLFOX was beneficial in terms of a statistically significant survival benefit. But that study was done in a population of patients that hardly exists anymore. These are patients that don't have a medical contraindication to receiving bevacizumab and did not receive it as part of their frontline management. So it was difficult to know how to put that information together. And it's important to recognize that then, as of now, the approval for bevacizumab is for use with chemotherapy in the first or second-line setting, not first and second-line setting. And the question has been open up until recently as to whether continuation of Bev beyond progression of first-line chemotherapy is a useful endeavor. The situation was, I think, very unfortunately confused by the publication of the so-called BRIGHT Registry. And I think that people misunderstand that publication. This was a non-randomized registry that took a look at what happened with patients when they were selected to receive further chemotherapy or further chemotherapy with bevacizumab. And it didn't really address the question in a meaningful way. It appeared to imply that the single most important thing you could do in treating a patient was continue Bev beyond progression. If we believe the BRIGHT Registry, the survival benefit was essentially a year. And it would be wonderful if we had an intervention we could do that would give us a median year overall survival benefit, but unfortunately, we're not there yet.
Although it was interesting to me that people were doing it quite a bit.
Yes, people were doing it. I believe the perception was that the toxicity was minimal and what could it hurt? I don't agree with that approach, but people were in fact doing it. I think they also had a misunderstanding that if they sent the bill and it got paid, that it was therefore approved. And of course, that's not the way these things work.
I also had a theory that it may seem crazy, but coincidentally, we saw in HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer this movement toward continuous anti-HER therapy. I know it's a completely different disease, but I kind of wonder if that affected it.
I think it did affect conceptually, even if it didn't really have a direct scientific applicability. I think you're right. Nevertheless, now we have some data. So it's late in coming. We would have loved to have seen this study quite some time ago. There were many geopolitical reasons why that didn't happen, but at least it has happened. And now we have a randomized study that directly addressed the question. And in this trial, whatever chemotherapy patients received first line, and we're talking about chemotherapy given with bevacizumab, they then received an appropriate second-line regimen. So interpreting this, if they had an oxaliplatin-based regimen, they got an irinotecan-based regimen. If they had an irinotecan-based regimen, they got an oxaliplatin-based regimen. And then they randomized to continue bevacizumab or placebo. And this study also shows in the range of a 1.4-month survival benefit for the continuation of bevacizumab. Now, it's important to emphasize, and I think Alan Vinook did a nice job of discussing this at ASCO following the presentation, that this is not a validation of the BRIGHT Registry. In fact, I would interpret it as a refutation of the BRIGHT Registry result. This isn't a one-year median survival benefit. This is a approximately six-week median survival benefit. So I think that's a very, very different finding. We need to recognize that, again, it's one of those benefits that's real, it's statistically significant. Intelligent discussion can be had as to whether or not it is clinically significant. In a setting where cost is not the issue of consideration, and that is in this day and age, most of the settings we find ourselves in with our patients, it seems to be a safe thing to do. And in the absence of a contraindication, I think it's what most of us will want to be doing. I think that the data do justify continued application of bevacizumab through multiple lines of therapy. And in fact, also as Alan speculated in his discussion, it somewhat begs the question, is there a reason to stop anti-VEGF therapy with chemotherapy? And I'm hard-pressed to see one. I can't imagine that anyone's going to do a third-line study. I think it is going to be a reasonable extrapolation that continuation of anti-VEGF provides modest but statistically significant benefit.
You know, and in terms of safety, I guess if the people got into the trial, maybe they tolerated it pretty well, but it didn't seem like it added much hypertension or complications to continue it.
Yes, and that was, of course, a concern that I find the trial very reassuring about, that when we think about anything that we might offer our patients, we're short-sighted if we don't consider that there could be a downside. And I think all too often in oncology and our zeal to be helpful to our patients, we can overlook that. These data are reassuring that the downside of continuation of Bev appears to be quite modest.
You know, it sounds like you're pretty open to considering this right now in your practice, assuming it can get paid for. Is that new for you? In other words, did this trial change your view of this?
Yes, this trial has changed my view because we didn't have data to support this practice before. And now we have an appropriately powered, well-done, randomized study that tells us what the upside and downside is.
I can recall asking this several times over the last couple of years, status post BRIGHT, and getting a different answer. So it's interesting.
Yes, and I would emphasize that it is different quality data. I don't believe that BRIGHT addressed the question. I do believe that this study does address the question.
So the other piece of the puzzle that we want to bring in there, and again was presented in the oral session, was more data from the VALOR study looking at the VEGF trap of aflibercept.
Yeah, that's an interesting kind of parallel development that is going to be a challenge to figure out how to interpret. Aflibercept's sort of been a long time coming. This is a drug with a long gestation period, and there's been a lot of scientific interest in it for, let's say, the better part of a decade. At the end of the day, I think it's going to be challenging to differentiate this drug from bevacizumab. You know, one of the things we do in oncology all the time is we beat our breast and say it's not a good idea to make cross-study comparisons, and then, of course, we go ahead and do it. So I shall hereby do that. I acknowledge that this is a dangerous and incorrect thing to do, and I will now make cross-study comparisons. If we make cross-study comparisons between the aflibercept data and bevacizumab, it would raise concern that there may be some increased toxicity with aflibercept relative to bevacizumab. Whether that is real or not, we don't know. So it's just sort of a cautionary flag to take a look at and think about. To some degree, the VALOR study is remarkably similar in outcome to the TML study. A weakness in the design of the VALOR study, in my opinion, is that there is variability as to whether the frontline patients received bevacizumab or not. And the focus of this particular ASCO presentation was to try to inform us on the issue of whether or not there is activity in aflibercept after progression on a bevacizumab-containing regimen. And while the statistical analysis failed to show interaction that would definitively say that it doesn't work, it was pointed out appropriately in the presentation that the data don't directly say that it does. So we don't know for certain that in a bevacizumab previously treated population that the activity of aflibercept is going to be similar. From the interpretation of the data, I think that there's a reasonable possibility of that. And if the TML bevacizumab study had not been presented, I think we'd all be saying, okay, let's use Bev, and then let's use our next chemotherapy with aflibercept. Now we have a difficult problem. We have nothing to suggest that aflibercept by itself, any more than Bev, has single-agent activity. We have nothing to suggest that either Bev or aflibercept provide activity with inactive chemotherapy. In other words, it's not like cetuximab, where irinotecan fails, and if you add cetuximab to irinotecan, that's better than using cetuximab alone. In Bev, you need to use it with active chemotherapy. The data suggests the same is true of aflibercept. So I don't know that aflibercept is opening a new therapeutic option. It's opening a choice. Do you want, assuming that the drug becomes available, and I think that that's a reasonable likelihood, you give your first line treatment with Bev. Do you want to do your second line treatment with continuation of Bev, or do you want to do your second line treatment with aflibercept? I think the data would allow you to have that choice, and we don't have a whole lot of information to help us make that choice. But if I have a patient who, let's say, fails second-line FOLFIRI Bev, I don't have any reason to think that treating that person with FOLFIRI aflibercept is a useful thing to do. And if I've already exhausted my standard chemotherapy with FOLFOX and FOLFIRI, I'm not sure how to bring aflibercept into the picture unless I choose to use it instead of second-line Bev. Either way, I'm not sure that these trials are additive. In other words, you have the benefit from the TML Bev study. You have the benefit from the aflibercept study. I think a patient can get one or the other. I don't see a way to get the benefit of both. What I'm concerned about is I hear some people speculating, well, everything's been exhausted, but if we have aflibercept, we can try that. I don't think we have data to support that. That it's somewhat reminiscent of something that I think has died down, but that we saw a lot of when panitumumab became available, is for a while the major use of panitumumab in the United States was as a salvage after cetuximab failure. And that never made sense. There's now data that says that that's an inactive approach, and NCCN guidelines have always specifically recommended against that.
You know, it's funny, over the years I've heard about, quote, VEGF trap, and I always ask people to explain it to me, and I never really quite got it until ASCO, when somebody put up a graphic, and it's really kind of a cool way they put this together. It looks like it's actually got parts of the VEGF receptor, and I guess it binds more different VEGFs than bevacizumab, which just binds VEGF-A, but the aflibercept binds VEGF-A plus some others. Is that your understanding?
That is correct, and its ability to do that is elegant. The design of it is very elegant. Whether at the end of the day that's a clinically relevant difference or not is still up in the air. I haven't seen clinical data yet that inhibition of different VEGF isoforms seems to matter. You know, we had a similar story with the PTK787. It's a very compelling preclinical idea, but so often something that makes perfect sense in the laboratory and on paper and in our minds doesn't pan out in the clinical arena. So I think that until we see some evidence that a VEGF trap regimen can rescue from a situation where bevacizumab cannot, to me, they are kind of a Coke and Pepsi sort of situation, similar to the way that I've been viewing panitumumab and cetuximab.
So a quick update on another issue, and your group really over the years has taken a leadership role in this, and we saw some more data from another group at ASCO looking at the issue of the patient who presents with a primary colon cancer and metastatic disease and what you do about the primary.
Yeah, so this is an area that's starting to become rather hotly contested, and I think we've got a number of different issues being considered. Our group, by way of background, looked retrospectively at a series of patients who presented with stage 4 synchronous disease, did not have their primary resected, and followed through whether the primary ever caused a problem. and 93% of patients got through their treatment and ultimately died of their metastatic disease without the primary being an issue that needed to be addressed. I think it's also important to consider that there is morbidity and mortality to primary surgery for the primary, so it's not an issue that one can ignore in thinking about these things. The data that were presented in the abstract at ASCO were looking back at populations of patients who did or did not have their primary resected, not in a randomized fashion, and purported to show a survival advantage for the people that had had the primary resected. It's very hard to postulate what a mechanism for such a thing might be, especially given the lack of evidence for a whole lot of immunogenicity of the primary of colorectal cancer, with very limited situation of the high microsatellite instability patients that have a lymphocytic infiltrate. We don't see much evidence of immune modulation. And so mechanistically, I have a problem understanding a phenomenon of that nature. In the absence of a prospective randomized study, you have enormous selection factors that could come into play in terms of the biases of who gets an operation and who does not get an operation. And in addition, you would be excluding from the analysis people who got an operation and died from it, or people who got an operation and got too sick to go on to clinical trials. So I think there are enough variables to make me very, very skeptical of those data. I think under the circumstances, we are not changing our practice. Our practice is very much that patients who present with a synchronous primary that is not overtly obstructing, we treat with chemotherapy up front. We're extremely impressed with the increased sensitivity of the primary relative to the metastasis. We see remarkable sensitivity both in our clinical trials and in practice. And so the need to resect the primary is very difficult to document. Some people worry about the primary being a source of perforation with bevacizumab. This, again, I think is another misunderstanding from the registries. In the registries, the group that had the primary in place had a higher incidence of GI perforation. But when you tease out those data, the perforations go anywhere up and down the GI tract and rarely, if ever, actually involve the primary site. So in my practice, where we have a lot of people on first-line bevacizumab-containing regimens with the primary intact, we don't have any patients where perforation occurred at the primary. And I'm only aware of one case that I have heard of in discussions, and I've gone looking for this. So I don't think that the primary as a site for perforation with bevacizumab is a concern that should dictate practice. It just doesn't seem to be panned out.
So I want to go on in a minute to HCC, but just to finish up on this, what about the NSABP trial that looked at this?
Yeah, so again, what we have is a non-randomized study that does seem to have a higher complication rate of the primaries than has been our experience, and higher complication rate than I can explain at this juncture. I need a little more time to ponder that. It's another piece of information that I think we need to consider. I'm a little worried about the degree to which people may have simply not paid attention to the primary and to symptoms and allowed some things to get very far along before they were attended to. If a person has a primary in place, one needs to be looking carefully for symptoms and inspecting that area early if there are problems, because it may require intervention. If one waits until symptoms get very advanced, that may be harder to deal with.
Anything new in terms of tissue testing with stage 2 disease? We saw some data in the past looking at the Oncotype colon assay. Where is that, and what about other assays trying to help us with this situation?
Sure. So there are a couple of commercial assays that are looking at multi-gene signatures, and there was even a presentation that looked at comparing those assays and pointed out that they didn't have a tremendous amount of agreement. And if you really wanted to have the best result, you needed to use all of them together, which I think is not a very practical solution. And I think it indicates that this is still a work in progress. I have not embraced using these assays in routine clinical practice, and NCCN thus far has not either. And the reason is that it's not clear to me that they really provide a decision point. When I'm looking for a marker, I'm looking for something that I can say, if it is this result, I'm going to go one way. If it's that result, I'm going to go another. all too often what these markers do is they either give me a comfort level or they give me a discomfort level, depending on the result, but I'm going to treat the patient the same way regardless of what goes on. So what we would really ideally like is the ability for an assay to tell us, regardless of a person's prognosis, who will improve that prognosis with chemotherapy and who will not. Because just telling me that a person has a good prognosis tumor doesn't tell me that I can't make that prognosis better with chemo, and just telling me that a person has a bad prognosis tumor doesn't mean I can make that person better with chemo. So in that context, I think we've got a ways to go. What I was encouraged to see was a presentation in the poster discussion section that the NSABP group is starting to look at the Oncotype DX assay to address the question of perhaps who does not benefit from oxaliplatin-based therapy in the better risk stage 3 patients. And this is something that I've been trying to suggest to the companies for a long time that are developing these assays. And the initial pushback, our information is that all oncologists are comfortable giving FOLFOX to all stage 3 patients. And my answer was, well, yeah, well, we shouldn't be. There's clearly a lot of neurotoxicity and long-term neurotoxicity involved in oxaliplatin. We don't want to miss an opportunity to help somebody, but we don't want to put somebody in harm's way unnecessarily. And it's very clear that we're giving oxaliplatin to a lot of people that are getting long-term neurotox and might have been just as well off without that exposure. So if we could get smart enough to use molecular signatures to identify a population for whom oxaliplatin really doesn't provide benefit and offer those people adjuvant therapy with just a fluoropyrimidine, which really is much less likely to have serious and or long-term toxicity, that would be a huge step forward. So I'm encouraged that that's starting, and I hope we see some positive results from that soon.
How about GI NET? Anything come out in that recently? And just where are we in general with this tumor?
Well, I think that one of the changes that we have embraced over the past year or two is a clearer understanding that within GI neuroendocrine tumors, there's two important different flavors, the pancreatic version and everything else. And the everything else we tend to call carcinoid. We've had a sense of this for a while, but now I think it's more established and universally accepted that the pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors have more treatment options and that something can be effective in one of these and not the other. So the use of sunitinib and the use of everolimus have, I think, become part of standard practice. Neither of these is at all likely to give us substantial tumor regression, but both are able to prolong progression-free survival and give us some, I think, clinically relevant disease control. What there's a lot of debate about is when to use these agents. And I'm a strong proponent of utilizing these agents when we need them. But when we need them is not necessarily when we make the diagnosis of a neuroendocrine tumor. I think that it's really important to understand the biology of each individual neuroendocrine patient. There are some patients whose disease is going to progress so slowly that we are able to watch them for literally years before we need to intervene. And there are other people for whom the disease is substantially more aggressive. It's often very difficult to know which is which when you first meet them. The likelihood that the patient's disease is going to be indolent is higher in those where it's an incidental finding. It's important first to weed out the poorly differentiated tumors. Those high-grade neuroendocrine tumors are a totally different animal. Those are essentially extrapulmonary oat cell carcinomas and should be treated with cisplatin-based regimens and should be treated early and aggressively. What we're talking about with these targeted agents, sunitinib, everolimus, are the well to moderately differentiated neuroendocrine tumors. And there, I find it very useful to start with an observation period of usually on the order of 3 months with the patient understanding if there's any new symptoms, call me, don't come back here sick without me knowing about it. And invariably, these patients come back looking as well 3 months later as they did. And then we see what happened on the scan. If there's little or no change, we do that routine again and we get a sense of how long we can follow them for. If there's very modest progression, we may think about starting an octreotide regimen as there seems to be compelling evidence now from the PROMID study and others that disease stabilization with octreotide can be accomplished in somatostatin receptor positive tumors. And if there's substantial progression, then we now, with the pancreatic tumors, would begin one of these targeted agents, or could treat them with temozolomide and capecitabine, which is also a regimen for which there's now some literature.
Oncologists have their ears open a lot right now about everolimus because of what's going on with breast cancer. What's been your experience in terms of side effects and toxicity?
So it's well tolerated by many, many people. But when you get severe toxicity, it can be very difficult on the patient and very long lasting. The particular, I think, worrisome variable is the mucositis. For many people, there's either no mucositis or very minor mucositis. But when you get a bad, painful mucositis in a patient, it takes a long time to get better. I think that that's really a problem. You know, we've certainly seen some infiltrative pulmonary toxicity and so on, but that has been infrequent and manageable when we take people off the treatment for the most part.
What are some of the common questions that you get from medical oncologists about GI neuroendocrine tumors?
I think that more oncologists are getting comfortable treating these tumors, which, depending on how much they're seeing, is either a good thing or not a good thing. I think that, like everything else, if you're doing it frequently enough, you get a feel for it. And if you're only seeing a neuroendocrine tumor once every 6 to 12 months, it's very challenging to have a comfort level with making the decision. So I think that a lot of oncologists that are following these patients are seeking the collaborative advice from a center where we see it frequently. So I find that the distance from which a neuroendocrine consultation comes will often be quite a bit larger than the average colorectal or common GI malignancy patient, and appropriately so, because we work with an oncologist who's in general practice, who's seeing a lot of colon and breast and prostate and lung, and would be really challenged to keep up with the subtleties of this rare tumor, but is very capable of executing a plan once we strategize together and put it in place. So I think that it's very hard to get a feel for a patient just from paper records or telephone conversation. And often it's useful for us to see the patients on a relatively infrequent basis to provide guidance.